Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. She is my good friend and business partner and Rebel Capitalist pro. Needs no introduction. Lynn Alden, welcome back, my friend.
Thanks for having me back.
Big day today. In fact, in the last hour, the Fed came out and raised rates by 75 basis points. Let's start there. What are your thoughts?
Well, so that was on track with expectations. So there, you know, there's a minor probability of them going extra hawkish. They didn't do that, so they took that off the table. The immediate response has been a drop in the dollar, a drop in treasury yields, and a jump in, you know, stocks, gold, things like that. And so kind of a risk on response. Sometimes these responses get unwound the next day as market participants have more time to parse the data. So I'm always very hesitant to read too much into initial responses. But in general, what we're seeing out of markets, you know, the longer term data with the yield curve inversion and kind of the weak economic indicators is that the market is starting to, you know, I think put a ceiling on what they expect the Fed to eventually be able to hike to, both in terms of, you know, forward expectations of rate hikes, I think are, you know, they've been diminishing, you know, depending on, there's multiple indicators that show that. So I think that's kind of the classic long-term debt cycle thesis, is that they find it very, very challenging to get the structurally positive real yields when debt is this high, even when inflation is, you know, substantial.
Yeah, the thing that really struck me is they raised by 75 basis points and the 10-year went down. I mean, that's
exactly, yeah.
That's just, I mean, it's almost like the 10-year's at the point where the faster they raise on the front end, the lower it goes, because the 10-year is saying, okay, now you've just increased the probability that we'll be in a recession even that much sooner. And I mean, is that what you're reading from the 10-year?
I think so. Basically, it's you can shift the balance of risks towards, is the Fed going to be too dovish and let inflation run hot, or are they going to be hawkish and purposely put the economy into recession and cool off inflation somewhat, but then with a sharp move down in risk assets. And so if you're deciding whether or not to put in treasuries, you know, the scenario where the Fed hikes and there's a recession, you know, and risk assets are struggling, those treasuries look pretty attractive. And so when their yield's going down, it means their prices are going up. And it's been a tricky time, because I've been a structural kind of bond bear, especially in real terms. But even, you know, in the past 6 weeks or so, you know, in my research, I've actually been more optimistic on some of the bond moves. You know, anytime you see kind of a historically extreme move in something, right? So we saw, like, the, you know, the first half of the year had like the biggest sell-off in bonds, you know, in like modern history. It was super contrarian to want to go in and be like, maybe we're topping in yields, or maybe, you know, this is a little bit overdone. And so I think in kind of a near-term sense, I think, you know, treasuries are a reasonable place to have at least some capital.
You and I just actually discussed that the other day, and I was thinking through that with Josh, and I'd love to get your take on this and tell me if I'm crazy, but I was thinking, okay, if I can buy a 1-year treasury today, let's say at 3%, and I just know my interest rate on Interactive Brokers is, let's say, 2.5, right? Why would I not borrow like $3 billion and buy 1-year treasury? Because the worst case scenario, I'm paid 50 basis points just to take a flyer on the Fed dropping rates back down to zero. Does that make sense, or have I lost my mind?
Well, anyone, yeah, if you have access to cheap capital, that's a reasonable trade to do going out, you know, for the rest of the year. And I think that betting on kind of a top in rates is probably a decent move. And that can be reflected in a number of positions. There's obviously some riskier ones to do and ones not. So what we saw so far this year is, for example, stock multiples, earnings multiples on stocks have compressed pretty significantly. As you've seen an unusually strong spike in rates, you've seen a sell-off in bonds, sell-off in stocks. And the question going forward is, okay, if rates are topping out, maybe the valuation pressure is done now on some of those companies. But then the question becomes, what's going to happen to their earnings side if we do encounter either a recession or some type of near recession type of environment? And so, you know, I think there's a certainly a way to play a top in rates. And it could be a bounce in gold. It could be a, you know, drop in the dollar. It could be, you know, going long on some of these treasury positions. I think there's multiple ways to play it. So some of the winners of the first half of the year, you know, dollar straight up and many, many other assets straight down. I think you could see somewhat of a reversal for some of those potentially.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How high do you think the Fed needs to take rates in order to bring on disinflation as measured by the CPI? And I guess another way to say that is, how much of an impact do you think asset prices have on the overall purchasing power of average Americans in aggregate total?
So that's kind of a moving target, but at the current time, I would say quite high. And so if you, as one measure, you can look at, say, household net worth as a percentage of GDP.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the higher that is, in some ways, the more financialized that economy is. And so, you know, in the dot-com, you know, obviously during raging bull markets, that'll hit a peak, and then during bear markets, that'll be lowered. So historically, it's been, you know, some reasonable multiple. During the dot-com bubble, you got up to like, all, you know, almost 4.5. So household net worth was 4.5 times as high as GDP, roughly. Then, of course, that came down significantly. Then it went up again in 2007. You know, but instead of, you know, in 2000, it was mostly in stocks, not really in real estate. In 2007, you had the opposite, where it was not a very euphoric time for stocks in general, but it was very euphoric for real estate. And what we saw going into this year was it got all the way up to over 6.
Yeah, 600%. Yeah, I did a whiteboard video.
Yeah. And so both stocks and real estate and bonds and everything was super high relative to GDP. And so that's a quite financialized situation, because if you have a big contraction in asset prices, you're going to get a number of factors. One is you're going to get, you know, the top 10% or so are the biggest consumers. And if they, you know, if their net worth is evaporating, they're not going to, you know, they're not on the margin. They're not going to be, you know, putting pedal to the metal in terms of things they want to buy. And then also you're likely to get more turbulence in tax receipts. Generally, there's a very strong correlation between the stock market in year-over-year terms and tax receipts in year-over-year terms. And so in general, I think that the market is very financialized. I think that the tail's gotten so big that it can wag the dog. And so I think that's part of, you know, kind of the softening that we've seen. And it also makes it's challenging to keep some of the markets liquid when they have that happening.
The bottom line there is, you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't think the Fed has to take real rates positive in order to bring on some disinflation?
Yes, basically yes. And so disinflation for people is different than deflation. It
right.
just means that the rate of inflation is going down. And one thing I've been emphasizing for a while is that even though I think this is an inflationary decade, that most inflationary decades have periods of disinflation within mm-hmm. an inflationary decade. It could be for any number of reasons. Maybe, you know, in some cases it could be because the supply side issues is getting temporarily addressed. Sometimes it's because the Fed or other central banks are fighting back and trying to curtail the demand side, which is what we're mostly seeing right now. And so I think what we're seeing right now is basically an attempt to like hold the beach ball underwater in terms of inflation. So it's, you know, do we have more refining capacity? No. Do we have, you know, materially more oil and gas production? No. So I think a lot of the underlying issues, that some of the inflationary pressures are still there. But I think that if you do curtail demand enough, I mean, if you seize up the housing market, which is generally what we've seen happen, if you do get a little bit more labor weakness, which we're starting to see materialize, then you can start to get disinflationary pressures. And so, for example, if oil, you know, went straight up, if that goes sideways for a year, right, that's zero inflation from the energy side. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying that's how you can think of it, where you can get a period of low inflation just because things that went up in price a lot can plateau for a period of time until whatever the next round up is.
Do you think that gives them cover to do more of the same as far as create excess? I shouldn't say excess, but create significantly more aggregate demand through like stimulus checks as an example, because that's what I always try to think through. Say we're going into a recession, you know, what's the government's response going to be? You and I have discussed this for, boy, probably going on longer a year now, that we've got to answer economic questions by answering political questions first and foremost. And I think the last conversation we had, you were saying how you saw 2022 and maybe 2023 being this like dunk fest on Twitter between the inflationists and the deflationists, pretty much based on however much deficit spending we were getting from the government, right? Or whatever the Fed was doing with their balance sheet. So I guess if we go into recession, we've got to think through what happens to the level of CPI. Is it trending down? And if so, does that give the administration and the Fed enough political cover to go ahead and maybe try to start propping up asset prices once again? What do you think there?
I think to some extent, if it gets bad enough, I think the response will probably be more muted than what we saw in 2020 and 2021, just because there's less of a shock to the system. And then two, because they saw pretty quickly some of the negative ramifications of what they did. I think they thought that there was a much larger disinflationary pool, you know, of factors than there were. So I don't think they thought that their inflationary response would be as impactful as it was. And also, I think that politics has become more gridlocked and is likely to get more gridlocked after the elections. And so I think it'd be challenging for them to pass sweeping things. But I think you could see more targeted types of stimulus, things that like, helping people food and energy, right? That sort of thing. So their prior stimulus, right? People could go and take it and buy like Dogecoin with it, right? So, which is not exactly what they were intending. So I think that you could see, we're already seeing out of Europe and some states, I mean, they do things like, you know, they'll take the tax off of energy, or they'll give people specific like energy stimulus. I think you could see more targeted things like that, especially if you get, you know, ongoing negative sentiment, donors calling out the politicians and being like, hey, you know, things are not great. What are you going to do about it? Right. So I think you can eventually get some sort of response, but I think it'll be more of a grinding period going forward. Yeah. I think we expect probably more overall stagflationary type of conditions. And, you know, my kind of base case is that the stock market capitalization to GDP, I think we've probably seen the highs for quite a while.
Okay.
And that does not mean, I mean, you could get higher nominal S&P 500, for example. You could get, you know, basically you could keep grinding up in nominal terms. But I think that the asset prices relative to the economy, you know, I think there's a good case to be made that period of zero rates, COVID response, you know, biggest ever liquidity injection in modern history, that might have been the kind of a pretty significant peak in terms of how financialized we are. And I think going forward, I think we're going to have higher average inflation, but again, disinflationary periods within that higher average inflation. And I think it'd be challenging for asset prices to get as high as they did, at least relative to GDP.
Okay. So let me push back on that slightly, because that's pretty much my base case as well, but to play devil's advocate here. So you've made a very strong case as to how aggregate demand will be a lot lower moving forward because aggregate demand has been so dependent on government deficit spending directly into the back pockets of the average Joe and Jane. So then is there an argument saying, okay, well, we had all of these supply chain disruptions that were brought on by the government's response to COVID in 2020, 2021. So, you know, the cure for high prices is high prices. So could we get the supply chains starting to fix themselves so we have more supply coming online with maybe less aggregate demand, and therefore the future might not be as inflationary as we think?
So I think around the margins, yes. And what I mean by that, for example, is one of the big things that happened during the past couple of years is in addition to a surge in demand, people also had a rapid shift in what they demand, right? So everyone was locked down and they said, well, let me buy a home and remodel it, or let me get a bunch of electronics or subscriptions, or, you know, whatever is going
to
make
services to goods.
Exactly. And that's really hard for goods. I mean, the supply chain can only support so much at one time. And you had a chip shortage, you know, basically there, I think some of those specific factors, yes, I think that, you know, they many of them already are easing.
Right.
And I don't think we're going to see such a rapid one-time change again. And so some of the congestion of supply chains at that peak level, I think it's a good case that's behind us. I think you could get disinflation in, you know, your ability to get certain many types of goods. For me, the more persistent inflationary pressures are on the energy side. I think that the supply response on energy is low, both in terms of production and then also refining capacity and transportation. And there's more frictions in general. I mean, if Europe has a severe natural gas crisis, they now have a very strong response to go out into the world and figure out how to get more other types of energy sources to bring down that. And that there's a natural response there. I mean, if you're a North American gas producer, you have a desire to build some LNG terminals and get them over to Europe because you'll get a much bigger spread on your product, much higher natural gas prices there, for example. And it becomes more economic for Europeans to burn other types of energy sources in lieu of natural gas. So it can bring up oil and coal and wood, things like that. And so I think that with that kind of hole in the global energy infrastructure, I think that, you know, this is an ongoing issue that's not going to be resolved quickly. I think that there's short-term types of oil like shale, and they can be brought online pretty quickly. You can get kind of these flexible responses. We actually haven't seen a ton out of that, but at least it's possible to ramp that up pretty quickly. But in order to truly bring more supply to market, some of those bigger projects, like offshore projects and things like that, have to be done, which means that an entity has to be able to look out, you know, 5 to 10 years and be confident that they're going to make a return on capital,
right?
Both in terms of oil prices being high and in terms of jurisdictions not, you know, changing their, you know, their rules or taxes around what that company can expect. And so I'm not seeing much supply response really broadly in energy markets. Of course, around the margins, there's always supply response, but I see nothing that indicates this is anywhere near over yet.
Yeah.
So
I think you had a way to articulate that, didn't you, Lynn, where you're saying the difference between CapEx and OpEx? Is that, am I saying that right?
Yeah, I was basically saying that, for example, I was more bearish on copper than oil because copper is a more discretionary and cyclical commodity,
right?
Because it's more tied up in construction and more tied up in projects that can be deferred. So I'm still bullish on copper when I look out very far into the future. I think that, you know, we look out by 2030, there's a copper deficit. But in that near term, you know, 18 month sense, I've been more very cautious around copper. Whereas that level of bearishness has not really applied to my view on oil and gas because that's a more OpEx commodity. Like you need it on an ongoing operations basis. Whereas copper is more discretionary. So I think that's
where demand is less elastic.
Yes.
Okay. So now let's bounce back to stagflation, because to get to stagflation, I guess, if you want to define it technically, we need higher rates of unemployment, and the unemployment rate is incredibly low. And I think that's one thing that the White House is leaning on, and the Krugman types and the Yellen types, when they say, well, you know, they're trying to front run GDP tomorrow and say, well, if we get 2 quarters of negative real GDP, it really doesn't matter because the economy is still booming. So just ignore those GDP numbers, because look at the unemployment numbers. So if we were to go into a stagflationary environment, how, with very low unemployment, I'm assuming you assume that the employment rate is going, or unemployment rate, excuse me, is going to increase. How do you see that playing out?
So one way I would describe it is if I was running a small business, and let's say I had 50 employees, if I ran into some sort of, weakness in demand, right? There's a couple things I could do. One is I could say I fire one of the employees. So I fire 2% of my employees. That's one option. Another option is I can give every employee a 2% pay cut and kind of reduce my labor costs that way. Of course, that doesn't work incentive wise, but that's essentially what we've seen actually in terms of real wages. So if you look over the past year, we had very strong wage growth in nominal terms, but it's also been the furthest below the inflation rate as it has been in many years, decades. And so workers across the United States on average got a pay cut this past year in terms of their ability to buy things. And that's compared to official CPI. It's worse if you compare it to, let's say, food at home. You know, that's higher than official CPI. If you look at high protein foods, it's higher yet. If you look at gasoline, it's higher than that. I think that's why we're seeing a discrepancy between, you know, record low consumer sentiment, but also low unemployment. And the, you know, I think there's a reasonable question to ask, why is that? And I think that's because, you know, people that are employed are still feeling, and in many cases rightly, that they're not being compensated for what their expenses are doing. And so in some ways, it's like everybody got a pay cut, not in nominal terms, because that doesn't really work, but everyone got like a pay cut in real terms. And that's what's translating into, I think, some economic malaise. And if
you look at let me say that a little bit differently. Sorry to cut you off there, Lynn. But if you think about why is the unemployment rate important? Why? You know, it's not the fact that people have jobs. It's the fact that people have purchasing power. So let's just say we're at zero unemployment, but people's purchasing power goes down by 50%. Isn't that basically the equivalent of the unemployment rate going to 20% or whatever the number is? And I think the mainstream economists, they get stuck in their models and they don't think through what those models actually mean.
That's a beautiful way to phrase it. I think that's exactly what's happening. And if you look at, for example, retail sales, if you look at it in nominal terms versus real terms, you'll see very different scenarios. If you look at it in nominal terms, it looks like demand for retail is booming. But if you then adjust it for inflation, you'll see that, you know, people are taking home less than they were taking home a year ago, even though they're paying higher prices. So, and if I used to go to the store and I got 10 things for $10, so I paid $100. If now, you know, I get, nine things, but each cost $12, right? My demand has been reduced. I'm taking home less things, even though I'm paying more dollars for them. And I think that's the environment that we're in. Basically, people are paying higher prices. Wages have not adjusted quickly enough to compensate for that. So we still have relatively low unemployment. It's trending in a weakening direction. So for the past 3 months, we've had higher trending initial jobless claims week by week. But it is still, you know, it's coming off from a strong base by those metrics. But in terms of the more important question, as you point out, that whether or not demand is lower, the answer is yes, because people are, you know, able to afford less because, you know, the prices have gone up faster than their ability to afford them.
Yeah. With your models, the way you see the economy, how do you factor in credit card spending? Because you hear this all the time. If we have an increase in credit card spending, that's, you know, you hear CNBC say, well, that this is great news because it means the consumer is very strong. But is it great news or is it bad news from the standpoint of it may imply that they're having to use their credit card more when they don't want to?
Yeah, I think that's, you have to go it down into the granular data. I think that, you know, in the way that we've constructed our financial system, credit is viewed as good. You know, if more credit's being taken out, different types of loans, then it must be good. It means the economy is going up. But of course, you know, people with a different economic focus would say that's not really a great thing. I think what's complicated about credit card data is that it's kind of diversified to other types of credit. So for example, one thing I pointed out is that credit card debt as a percentage of GDP, you know, even though there's been a somewhat of a sharp uptick in credit card debt lately, if you just map total credit card debt as a percentage of GDP, it's at kind of like near multi-decade lows. You know, we hit a peak, a while ago, you know, kind of in the run-up to the global financial crisis. And ever since then, there's been less emphasis on consumer credit. It's partly because, you know, financial companies are more cautious with the types of loans that they do, including, you know, who gets access to high credit. And it's likely it's also because I think we've seen somewhat of an emergence of shadow banking, right? So there's like, you know, buy now, pay later. I think that can make the data somewhat murky. But I think in general, we have seen it is generally harder for low credit people to access credit than it was, say, 15, 20 years ago. And so, you know, when it comes to credit card data, I think it's something worth watching, but it's not something I've been putting tremendous stock on either way.
Let me get your opinion on something else. I saw a chart the other day and it just blew me away. And this was a chart of the median checking account balance for like four different income brackets. So the lower 25%, two middle, and then the higher 25%. And the percentage increase from the end of 2019. You know, I'm like you, I think we're going to go through a 1940s to a certain degree, maybe 1970s, but definitely some ups and downs, see some disinflation. So I thought that Q3, Q4, we'd get a little disinflation. But that's because I thought the purchasing power that people had based on stimmies and PPP and whatnot was coming to an end. But what I didn't realize is the median checking account balance for like the lower 25% income bracket is still 75% higher than it was in 2019. And for the top 25 income percent bracket, I think it was like an additional 25%. And so I thought, well, how can these people still have this much money? And I didn't realize that the people with student loans haven't had to pay that back yet. And they don't have to start paying that back. I think it's till September, October. On top of that, people still can apply for mortgage forbearance. And I didn't even know that was still a thing. And yet it's going on behind the scenes. So my point there is, when you're thinking about inflation or disinflation, have you thought about the fact that the checking account balances are still significantly higher than they were in 2019? How do you layer on that statistic?
So the interesting thing about broad money is there's unintuitive things about how it's created and destroyed. And something we covered quite extensively over the past couple of years is the two major ways to make new broad money. One is that banks lend it into existence. And the other one is that the government can run large fiscal deficits that the central bank monetizes, basically helicopter checks that are paid for by the Fed, essentially. And those are the two main ways to substantially increase broad money supply. And then, so the question becomes, how would you destroy broad money supply? And you have essentially the reverse of one or both of those things. So either the government is running large surpluses and taking money out of the economy, you know, good luck. And then the other one is loans are being destroyed, either they're being defaulted on or paid down. And so they're basically that's a way to destroy broad money. And because we don't see either of those two things happening, we're not seeing a downward move in broad money supply. We're seeing a slowing growth of broad money supply because we're not actively sending out helicopter checks anymore. But we're still seeing, and you know, we've had kind of a mild contraction because there's variables around the margins that can, you know, affect money supply. But basically, we got at all-time highs, and then we've been chopping along for a period of time. So all that money is still in the system. If someone you know, had their checking account boosted up and then they spent it, you know, that money doesn't disappear. It's going to someone else. And then they receive that extra money. And the question is, what do they do with it? And if they spend it, it goes somewhere else. So it either keeps circulating or it ends up being hoarded somewhere. Someone, unless either loans are being paid down or the government is sucking money out of the system with you know, fiscal surpluses, that money is you know, it's permanently in there now. And so that's the way I'm kind of analyzing it in terms of, you know, if you go back to the 1940s, you had these huge inflationary spikes. But then when the inflationary spikes were done, you had these plateaus where there's now permanently more money in the system and the aggregate price level is now permanently higher. That doesn't mean that there can't be pockets of things that might have gone down. I mean, if the government needed a ton of copper for the war and then copper spikes and then they don't need that copper anymore, you could get a collapse in copper prices, for example. That's like, yeah, you know, one specific thing, but the aggregate price level is higher. And so the way I've been phrasing it in this environment is like, you know, Chipotle did price increases and wage increases, and those are never coming back down. We're not going to see a reversal. We're not going to see negative inflation among a lot of these kind of permanent price increases. You know, you can see it around the margins of certain commodities or certain, you know, certain pockets of things that maybe spiked way too high due to bottlenecks. But I think the broad level is permanently higher because there's permanently more money in the system. And essentially what it comes down to is each unit is worth a little bit less. So if you were to look at those checking accounts, but then you say you redenominate those in how many gallons of gasoline does that person have saved up? Right. Or how, you know, how many, you know, what is their ability to buy a house? Right. So I think when you do it that, you'd see a smaller increase, right? Because gasoline prices also went up quite a bit since 2019. And so did the median house price and things like that. So they have, in some ways, not a huge stockpile of extra ability to buy things, even though they have a much higher stockpile of cash. Yeah. But it would come down to specific numbers. But yeah, I think that's still in generally an inflationary force, or at least a force that prevents an absolutely sharp decrease in prices back down to, say, prior levels, because all that money is still out there.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level. As a thought experiment, let's just say we gave everyone $1 million, and let's say we just kept the supply side the same. Do prices just adjust up and then plateau, or do prices continue to go, let's say prices adjust up, let's just say 100%. Did they stay at that 100% level and plateau, or do they go and they increase higher year after year after year? Because I think that there's a lot of individuals that watch my YouTube videos, I see them in the comments, they think that because the government, quote unquote, printed all this money in 2020, that means we'll see high rates of consumer price inflation indefinitely into the future, let's say for the next 10 years, because it's in the system. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I'm saying, you know, as a thought experiment, do you think we would just see those prices plateau or continue to increase as a result of a one-time payment to everyone?
I think you'd see a one-time increase in prices, and therefore, if you ran average inflation over that decade, it'd be pretty high, but it would have been all concentrated in a pretty brief period,
right?
So after that, you could get a pause in rates going up. Prices going up. Now, I think in reality, it'd be messier than that, because it does take time for that to trickle through. So if everyone got $1 million in their account, some people would run out and buy stuff right away. You'd start to get empty shelves and too much demand relative to supply until price started adjusting upward to reflect the fact that there's more money in the system and that demand is overwhelming supply. And then you'd eventually find like an equilibrium where we've essentially debased the currency enough that things kind of return to normal, but that everything is priced higher now, or at least most things. So I think, and then it would come down to the only thing that would make it keep going up is if there was like some sort of ongoing, like if people lost faith, if they're like, oh, they're just going to do it again. And then say the entire international community wants to sell that currency because they're like, what's from stopping them from doing it again? Mm. Right. So you could get some sort of nonlinear confidence sea change for international demand for that currency that could cause a more persistent inflationary pressure. But as kind of a localized thought experiment, yeah, I'd go more with that one-time plateau, higher prices.
How significant or how much of an impact do you think higher oil prices have on consumer price inflation? Because obviously they impact it to a certain degree. We went up to $150 a barrel oil. But what I've noticed from the chart is when oil price spikes very high, very quickly, often you get a recession right after that, where you would expect some disinflation and those prices to come back down and kind of quote unquote normalize. So I guess the question is, how do you see higher oil prices impacting consumer price inflation?
So I've run some data on this over like say 120 year period, and there's very strong correlation between oil prices and inflation, particularly in say rate of change terms. And so the way I like to look at it is in these 5-year rolling increments, because 1 year is very noisy.
Yeah.
But if you chart out say 5-year cumulative CPI growth and 5-year cumulative oil price changes, you'll see that oil is more volatile than CPI, but that it's very strongly correlated. You have these huge spikes in oil, and that results in a significant increase in CPI. The biggest exception was the 2000s decade, where you had the level of oil price spike that we got in the data should have contributed to more CPI and didn't. And part of that is due to how we changed CPI, but a lot of other it was real. And it was there was an unusually large decoupling there. And my view is that was because of globalization forces, right? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of at the peak rate of when we were like aggressively sending jobs to China. Basically, we were opening up this whole new world of untapped labor. There was all this extra supply for labor and manufacturing and things like that. And so there was less domestic wage pressure and less other kind of, basically we had an unusually big disinflationary impulse to offset what would otherwise be a very strong inflationary force. But you still had a positive correlation. It was just a much weaker correlation, or at least a bigger decoupling in terms of magnitude. But I think that, my base case in the 2020s is we get another kind of increase in oil prices, and that this time we don't really have as much disinflationary offsets as we had during that period of peak globalization. Another way to phrase it is that if you look at, say, oil prices are denominated in gold over the very long term, it's kind of this big zigzag pattern. You're just, an ounce of gold can buy about as many barrels of oil as it could many, many decades ago. You have periods of high oil prices if there's, constraints on supply. You have periods of low oil prices if you're in like a recession. But in general, you're just kind of chopping along in this big volatile range sideways. Whereas if you look at oil price in dollars or any other fiat currency, you get more of like these like permanently higher plateaus every couple decades. So generally in those inflationary decades, so you got a big stepwise change up in the 40s, another big stepwise change up in the 70s, another big stepwise change up in the 2000s. And then, once you have that kind of, new period and not a lot of supply comes online, you generally get these more disinflationary sideways to down trending periods at this new higher normal until you run into the next CapEx and demand cycle. So that's generally how I see oil markets.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. As far as commodities, that's something that I've given a lot of thought to, because I think it's most likely we're in a long-term super cycle, and it's pretty much because of the supply side. Do you want to explain to people why there's a structural issue that could impact, or most likely will impact, oil prices and net gas prices, those OPEX commodities that you were talking about? And where I'm going with this is people think that, you can just start an oil mine or just start drilling oil and it's just bam, you get more supply, but they don't realize that takes sometimes a decade to do that. So often that there is the cure for high prices is high prices, but that takes a long time to play out.
Yeah, if you look at the long-term commodity CapEx cycle, it's a pretty long period. I mean, there's multiple years of bull market and then usually even longer years of bear market. And because it's, as you pointed out, these things take time in order to have all the feedback loops kind of get recognized and resolve the issue. And so you have a period where, there's oversupply of commodities. So that's basically a market signal telling everyone not to invest in new commodities. Don't bring new production online because it's not going to be profitable. But then during that period, demand keeps inching up and the existing supplies keep dwindling until eventually you get, squeezed in one way. Eventually either there's a big fiscal response that increases demand, or just the supply side gets weak enough that the existing demand just starts to cause higher prices. And that takes, but it's not like we can just snap our fingers and, there's tons of new supply. It then takes years of high prices to encourage a lot of new production to come online. Because at first, you see a price spike, but if you're going to make a decision to, do a 5 to 10 year project, potentially worth billions of dollars to bring new supply online, you have to be pretty sure that that's a persistent higher price level. And so it could take quite a long time at structurally higher prices to start encouraging more supply to come online. And so that's generally the cycle. And then we can overlay some specific things here. So, there have been all these calls for like peak oil, right? And those ended up being premature because we were able to tap into oil that we didn't know we could get before with shale oil. You know, the combination of cheap credit and some new technologies allowed us to bring on what were previously considered unconventional oil sources. And I think that's always kind of a risk, is people underestimate human ingenuity when they you know, talk about peak this or peak that. But I think that we're kind of revisiting that now because, you know, we did really reach kind of peak conventional oil. And then we brought on a lot of this unconventional stuff. And then the question is, have we reached sort of a rough peak in that too? Luke Groman refers to it as peak cheap oil, right? Mm. And then that's kind of a way to describe it, that, you know, sure, you might be able to get more oil, but the sources that we know how to get pretty easily, you know, like say OPEC, for example, you know, they might be, you know, closer to the higher end of their potential output. And we already, you know, we brought on a lot of North American shale. We probably can bring on more, but it's got pretty rapid decline rates. So it's kind of like, you know, running on a treadmill, right? It's very hard to structurally increase and then keep increasing the, you know, the yearly shale output. And so I do think that, and then you throw in ESG, and you also throw in perceptions among major pools of capital that, you know, oh, we're not going to need that oil stuff in 5-10 years. Let's go elsewhere. And you bring all these different forces together, and I think it's a very underinvested space in terms of bringing new supply online.
That's what I was going to say. Maybe we've reached peak capital investment.
Yeah.
You know, that there's just not going to be, I mean, you got to put yourself in the position of one of these CEOs that runs an oil company. If everyone is telling you that we're going to wean the entire economy off of your commodity in the next 10 years, how much are you going to invest in producing more of that commodity? Probably not too much. You're just going to let prices run and just, it is what it is until we get to that electrified global economy that we're supposed to get to in 2030 or 2050. So that was my point there, is that maybe we've hit that peak investment cycle as well.
At least I think for a period of time. I think that, you know, if the beatings continue, morale can improve. So I think that, you know, if prices just keep grinding sideways and higher over time, and quality of life keeps going down, and I think eventually public perceptions around that could change if some of the technologies don't emerge at the pace that they expect them to, let's say.
Yeah.
And there's also that challenge that, you know, a lot of those electrification technologies ironically require a lot of hydrocarbons. It takes a lot of hydrocarbons to get all those materials out of the ground. If you snap your fingers and gave up, you know, said, okay, in 10 years, everyone's going to have an electric car, the question becomes, well, where are we going to get all that copper and nickel from? You know, our existing understanding of where we have copper and nickel, like proven reserves, are not necessarily sufficient for that. And so the question becomes, can we bring on large new amounts of copper? That's why I'm bullish on copper long-term, even though I've been very concerned about copper in a cyclical sense. I think when you look out long enough, we have pretty significant copper deficits that have to be addressed. And so I think that, you know, there's really no way around kind of real world constraints for stuff. We need molecules. And the question becomes, you know, do we want to put them in our cars directly? Do we want to put them in the grid and have our cars get the power from the grid? Do we want to go into hydrogen? There, you know, there's multiple ways to go here, but everything at the core comes down to energy density and productivity.
Yeah. Very well said. You've got to have the diesel fuel to get the copper out of the ground.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I know you and Brent were going back and forth on Twitter a little bit the other day. And so why don't we start by going over your kind of next a year time horizon with the dollar, we'll say the DXY. And then where do you see things a little bit different than Brent?
So I think, well, the big wild card is the euro, because the dollar index is so heavily euro focused, and I'm not exactly bullish on the euro. You know, unless we see just, you know, ceasefire and everybody's friends again right away, right? So, you know, kind of a base case, I think that Europe is struggling. So one thing I've been looking at a lot, you know, when facts change, you have to change your outlook, right? So once we started to see in late 2021, European natural gas prices look like a Weimar chart, you know, any sort of reflection on the dollar index has to adjust to account, you know, kind of account for that. If they mismanage energy policy enough to have a, you know, idiosyncratic continent specific problem, then that becomes partially a dollar problem, but partially it's a euro problem. And so I've been looking at the dollar compared to other currencies, you know, the Canadian dollar or the Brazilian real or rubles or yuan, for example. And so we've seen unusual weakness out of the euro and the yen. And the dollar has been strong relative to other currencies, but not necessarily what we'd expect from looking at the dollar index alone. So we don't see, you know, the dollar still below its, you say, 2020 highs against Canadian dollars, against yuan, against many of those other currencies. So I'm not super bullish on the dollar relative to some of the current account surplus countries, but I'm bullish on it compared to, say, some of the frontier markets, right? The ones that are don't have enough reserves and have dollar-based debts and are getting squeezed. And I'm also, I don't really have a strong opinion about dollar versus euro and therefore dollar index, mainly because there's so many tail risks with the euro. The yen's interesting because, you know, right now, so they've kind of decided that they're going to hold yields at the expense of their currency. So they're doing formal yield curve control. And so then it partially comes down to that differential between dollar rates and yen rates. And so if the Fed eventually gets to a point where they stop hiking, and if macro happens on the margins, then the question is what happened, you know, does the dollar keep going up relative to the yen, or does that start to find kind of a plateau for a period of time? And so that'd be my base case, is that when the Fed eventually gets to the end of its hiking cycle, or, you know, even front running that to some extent, because the market can start pricing in that the Fed's getting to the top of its hiking cycle. I think you could see a local peak, at least in the dollar compared to other sensible currencies, let's call it, right? So in some sense, they're all, you know, unsensible, but, you know, compared, you know, the dollar compared to countries that are not having an outright kind of energy crisis or outright breakage in their system. So, you know, I think that we've been in an environment where dollar up, most other things down. And I'd be on the lookout for potential reversion in some of those trades when you look out far enough.
Yeah. So just we've got the dollar there. Well, let's get to gold. I want to touch base there and then circle back to a couple questions. But I want to get to gold before I forget, because I know a lot of the audience is really interested in your opinion on maybe the gold and gold miners.
So gold has held up better than the S&P 500 this year, even though there, you know, it's not been obviously very, very great overall. And it generally does pretty well in those declining PMI environments, so economic deceleration, and generally underperforms during rising PMI environments. Gold's performance over the full cycle has been rather disappointing, right? It didn't go as high as many people thought. And, you know, I would have expected it to probably be over 2000 here, but it's not. I think it makes more sense when you consider like what Incrementum does. Like they have like a fund that's like, you know, gold and Bitcoin.
Yeah, Ronnie. Ronnie Stuferle.
Yeah, and it harvests that volatility that occurs between them, right? So Bitcoin generally does better in risk on environments. Gold generally does better in risk off environments. And what they share in common, obviously, is that they're scarce monies that can be self-custodied, right? That's how they're perceived. And of course, they have different strengths and weaknesses, different risks. And so a basket of that gets rebalanced has actually done quite well, you know, over the past several years. Gold has somewhat struggled relative to Bitcoin, but of course, Bitcoin had really sharp moves down at certain points as well. And so I think that what happened to gold is less surprising if you consider that there was some degree of market share dilution. You know, some people that might have otherwise bought gold bought Bitcoin, and even though it had a big crash, it's still much higher lows than its prior lows. And so there is a contingent that has just gone into Bitcoin, at least so far. So I kind of put those together. And then gold miners, they've had the challenge of you know, their expenses, like their energy expenses are high, while gold has kind of been in this range, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the real test will be what happens when the Fed stops hiking due to, you know, just the market's putting a lot of pressure on it to eventually stop hiking. And I think that's where, it's hard for gold to do a ton in dollar terms when the dollar is going straight up.
Yeah, right.
But I think that when you start to get, you know, kind of a, like we talked about, potentially a local top in the dollar and kind of a realization that the Fed can only inflate inflation so far, and that it probably needs an extended period of negative real yields, that's where I think you could get a little bit more demand in gold.
Yeah. So on that note, how far do you think the Fed can go? I mean, I know Gundlach talks about the 2 year all the time, that the Fed basically follows a 2 year. I didn't look at it before we got on here, but I'm guessing the 2 year is probably around 3%. So do you think Fed funds can get that high before they pause, or what's your opinion?
I think potentially. Yeah, I think the 2 year roughly represents with a lag where the Fed can get to. So that's kind of how I'm using it as a base case.
Yeah.
We can also look at how much the Fed can push after the yield curve is already inverted, which is generally would be a somewhat lower ceiling because it's already inverted. So on one hand, the more dovish case is kind of the Luke Gromin thesis that, you know, that they're really not going to get much further than they're already at, if at all. And some of the more hawk, I would think that's a possibility, but it's, you know, my expectation would be a little bit more hawkish than that. But then there's the very hawkish view of people that think that they actually can normalize this whole thing and then get to a period of positive real rates and they'll get inflation down. And, you know, so I disagree with that view. So my general expectation, unless they start to see signs of the opposite, is that they hike into quarter four, potentially at a lower pace than they have been, you know, get around to where the 2 year got, and then they probably run into more acute issues if they try to go much further than that. Mm. If Powell truly thinks he's Volcker and tries to really, really press it, I mean, they could, you know, might be able to get a little higher than that, but then I think you'd have such dysfunction and such liquidity issues that you probably would, you know, they'd probably have to step in and reliquify the treasury market or something like that would be materializing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So basically, I mean, maybe another 75 basis point hike. Maybe that comes in two different waves, or maybe just one, and they've got to take pause and then maybe go back down. I think Luke was talking about them actually lowering rates this year. I don't want to put words in his mouth. Maybe he meant just pause by the end of this year. But yeah, we'll see. I think that's interesting when you layer on top the Fed funds rate with the 2 year and see how much of a correlation there is right there.
That's been a lot of my research over recent weeks. Basically, layering that over the 2 year or layering that over the yield curve. Basically, the various market forces are essentially trying to tell the Fed what to do.
Yeah. What do you think about the fact that we went from the 2 year, I think it first inverted in April. I'm trying to look at my whiteboard. I have a chart up there. And then, you know, everyone in the mainstream media is like, oh, it's nothing to see here, nothing to see here. No problem, because unemployment rate is still low. And then we get the 1 year. And then the other day I noticed, maybe a week ago, the 6 month is inverted, and now the 6 month is inverted by like 20 basis points. So, I mean, what is the yield curve telling us there, Lynn?
I think it's like clockwork. Every time the yield curve inverts, there's always a bunch of people that say, well, this time's different. It's not saying what it normally says. And, you know, it always takes some finesse, because if you look at global markets, the yield curve's not as predictive of their recessions than it is in the US. It's really, you know, it's especially a US phenomenon. But there is, you know, there's some signal elsewhere, but it's the highly predictive version of it is in US markets. And there are a handful of different yield curves to look at. And so you can look at, you know, a handful of them together to get the strongest signal. But I think that it came down to the common thing. I mean, people didn't want to think that a recession could be coming, and that it could be inverting so quickly, after it inverted last time. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not been a very long period since the pre-COVID inversion. And so I think that a lot of people were kind of in disbelief that the signal could be telling what it's always telling, which is, either recession or at least significant economic weakness.
Yeah. It was funny. I incorporated a blog post from the Fed going back to March in today's whiteboard video, where they tried to dismiss the inversion of the twos and tens. And they said that in their research, that this doesn't matter. So don't pay any attention to it, because what happens is the average Joe and Jane see the inversion of the twos and tens, and then that prompts them to start spending less. And this brings on the recession. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if we just forgot about the twos and tens, then we'd never have a recession and we wouldn't have to worry about it.
It's funny how mental gymnastics that people do, but
yeah.
And the original studies, I think we're on the 10 year and 3 month. That's in some ways the most predictive one. The 10-2 is also quite predictive. There are a couple kind of like near misses there. Like it's not, it's at the, whatever.
It's like mid-60s, you know, I think.
Yeah, there were a couple like periods where it got kind of squirrely. But essentially the 10 year 3 month is a slightly lagged version, which is basically just affirming the fact that the Fed's always going to hike on a lag, you know. So the 2 years predicting what the Fed's going to do, and then the 3 month is kind of more representing what the Fed's actually doing.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a little bit on a lag with that. And so I think the 10-3 is a little bit more predictive of timing. But this whole period was condensed, right? So we had the biggest ever liquidity injection, or at least the biggest in modern history, and then the biggest kind of like pivot in terms of like trying to claw liquidity back out of the system they've seen in a long time. And so it's perhaps not surprising that signals that might have normally been leading are instead coincident, because if it's compressed enough, you know, that can be a pretty challenging environment. Another thing the reason I was taking the yield curve seriously is that if you looked at the copper to gold ratio, that was saying the same thing. I mean, copper was like, you know, generally in rising PMI environments, you'll have copper outperforming gold. And then in falling PMI environments, you'll have copper underperforming gold. And that's pretty much like clockwork. And we're seeing PMIs rolling over. Copper to gold is rolling over. Yield curve was flattening and eventually inverting. I mean, it was like this, it's like, there's only so many things you can see happen until you have to conclude, you know, either recession or at least, you know, recession-like conditions. I mean, severe economic slowdown.
Yeah, yeah. And if your base case is right, the Fed raises to, let's say, the 2-year, around 3%, most likely that would be above where the 10-year is, concerning the fact that they raised by 75 points today and the 10-year went from, call it 2.78 down to 2.73. So yeah, that would lead you to believe that we'll get to that 3-month, if not Fed funds being above the 10-year within the next few months. I know we're running short on time, Lynn, so I want to ask you about Bitcoin. And one thing that I've noticed that I find could be a bullish sign is, my goodness, you could not have more bad news in the crypto space than we've seen over the past, 2-3 months, something like that. And I know now, isn't like Coinbase being investigated or something like that? And it's like Bitcoin, it takes like a $1,000, $2,000 hit, $3,000, maybe it dips down to $18,000, $19,000, and then it just bounces right back up to $20,000 or $21,000. And with all that bad news, it's kind of shaking it off. And although it's a lot lower than it was, it seems like it might be kind of forming a bottom here. So I want to get your opinion on that. And then Grayscale trading at such a discount to NAV.
Yeah, so in general, if you could buy from people that are forced liquidators, that tends to be a decent position to be in, right? So if you're buying like oil, you know, when oil went negative, and if you're buying Bitcoin, I think from whales that are like, you know, got over their skis with, you know, using Bitcoin as collateral and then buying all coins on leverage with it, and they're going bankrupt. So, you know, I'm always happy to be a buyer of people that are getting liquidated. When something stops going down, despite bad news continuing, that's generally a good sign for a reversal. Like, you know, you've already priced in pretty catastrophic news.
Yeah.
If you look at various, just say, on-chain indicators or other things like that for Bitcoin, it's in one of those like firm value zones where, you know, it's below its on-chain cost basis. So people bought Bitcoin and they took it out, put it on their hardware wallet. And those prices, I mean, if you can run analytics on the blockchain and determine what is the average price that each Bitcoin last moved, or each fractional Bitcoin, each UTXO. And when you aggregate those together, you get what is essentially an average on-chain cost basis. And historically, when Bitcoin goes slightly below the average on-chain cost basis, that generally starts marking, you know, if not the bottom, at least kind of a deep value range that is, you know, generally been, looking back 3 years in the future, a really good buying opportunity. And right. So, but it's always a thing. I mean, the future is never, just because something in the past happened, you know, 3, 4, 5 times, doesn't necessarily mean that the future has to play out like that. And so I've been looking at, you know, just strength of the network, development on the Lightning Network, kind of the some of the startup capital going into that space. The maker of it was CoinKite. They make one of the hardware wallets. They were seeing that they had a spike in sales during that liquidation, which is not something they normally see. So there's, you know, kind of a lot of buyers getting into some of the Bitcoin self-custodial hardware. I think there was an urge of people wanting to take their coins off of some of those lenders and things like that, and get them back.
Sure.
So I'm pretty optimistic long-term on the health of the network. Generally, it does pretty poorly in falling PMI environments, pretty strong in positive PMI environments. But one thing we've generally noticed also in history is that Bitcoin usually bottoms before PMI bottoms. And I think that's in large part because liquidity tends to bottom before PMI bottoms. And so we've kind of washed out a lot of the hidden leverage. Some of it I saw coming, like the whole Luna fiasco. I wrote extensively about that, mm-hmm. and even talked about that they might have to sell their Bitcoin into a weak market that could mark a major capitulation. So that kind of played out exactly as feared, whereas the Three Arrows Capital liquidation, kind of the second leg, I mean, they were actually crippled by the whole Luna thing, but the whole second shoe to drop was that Three Arrows Capital and then the whole kind of a cross-lending environment.
Right.
So we got like that 1-2 punch that really kind of started with the Luna fiasco. But I'm more optimistic on the network now than I was, 6 months ago. It's something I've been, in my research reports, I've been saying, okay, I'm bullish on Bitcoin long term, but falling PMI environment, it really could be either way here. And I started writing about Luna. But now that we've kind of had some of these capitulations, I do like it here pretty long term. And then the Grayscale thing is interesting. I mean, you're getting at a 30% discount to NAV.
Yeah, I want to be clear. I think one of the biggest reasons to own Bitcoin is to have purchasing power outside of the whole system. It's not counterparty risk. So I think you should, if you don't own it, or if you don't hold it, you don't own it, like Lynette says about gold. But it's just a speculative play. That's why I was asking the question about Grayscale, because of its discount to NAV.
Yeah, I think the best Bitcoin is self-custodial Bitcoin. But there are pools of capital that, let's say they want a slice in their IRA or something. They want, they want some sort of paper representation of Bitcoin's price within their diversified pie of assets. And GBTC is still one of the ways to do it. It's partial play on Bitcoin price itself. And then it's also partial play on what is the probability in the next, say, 3 years that a spot ETF gets allowed, right? So Canada has one, some other countries have one. The United States has so far not allowed one. And so if GBTC could ever convert to an ETF, they could, that difference could be arbitraged quite quickly. I mean, ETFs, that's how they're different than those closed-end fund type of mm-hmm. holdings. And so you basically have the combination of Bitcoin price action and then potential for closing of that gap. But of course, you also have risk of, if it goes 30%, there's nothing preventing it necessarily from going to like 40% discount to NAV if things get worse. So there is downside risk, but I do think GBTC is a reasonable paper representation of Bitcoin if someone does have that long-term view. But of course, they have all that counterparty risk and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And then is there an argument that maybe there could be another ETF that would pop up that would take business away from Grayscale if they didn't get there first?
It's possible. You'd have that arbitrage. So someone would have to decide if they want to own Bitcoin or if they want to own Bitcoin at a discount. There's nothing that prevents a couple spot ETFs from appearing over time. And so even if Grayscale weren't first, they could eventually join the
party. because it's already trading at such a discount to NAV. So then if it gets that ETF, then you get the market maker in there that would suck up that arbitrage to bring the price up.
Yeah, potentially. And also, it just comes down to, let's say a company like Fidelity gets the first spot ETF. There's nothing that would prevent maybe Grayscale from getting the second spot ETF. Like there's no rule saying there can only be one, kind of like how there are multiple gold ETFs and some of them have different pros and cons and nuances and expense ratios and liquidity and different details of how they operate. It's quite possible you can get multiple spot Bitcoin ETFs if there's market demand for it. So there is demand to eventually unlock that discount. And the question is, spot ETFs, the cleanest way to get there. There are some other ways to do it, but that's kind of the closest path, but it is a risk to consider. I think the best Bitcoin is self-custodial, but there are, pools of capital and paper assets that might want some price exposure for, small slice.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm doing a model portfolio for Rebel Capitalist Pro where I put in $100,000 and I'm just allocating it and kind of documenting the process. And I can't really, it's in an IB account, so I can't really buy Bitcoin with it. But I was thinking maybe I'd just do the Grayscale as a representation of that slice that I would normally allocate to Bitcoin, just owning it and not having that counterparty risk. All right, Lynn, thank you very much for your time. As always, a fantastic conversation. For my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
So I'm at lynndalton.com, active on Twitter at lynndaltoncontact. And I'm also part of the Rebel Capitalist Pro platform that you do.
That's right. So you got to check it out. All right. When are you going to Egypt?
That'll be in September. I'll be spending a month in Egypt.
That's the next big vacation. So are you looking for investment opportunities there? Some real estate maybe?
I would like to. You know, real estate there is pretty cheap because you're not very supply constrained. But, you know, especially on kind of a cash flow type of basis, you can get some decent investments there. And it helps to have family and friends, you know, in the country. So it's something I always consider, but it's something I've never really pulled the trigger on yet.
Yeah. So, well, you'll have to give us the update there. I know Chris bought in Dubai like a year ago and he's made like 20 or 30% on those apartments. But we saw that one coming a long time ago and we were talking about it in Rebel Capitalist Pro. But anyway, thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.